SBS Radio.
Thank you. Yes, it's interesting when you read your own CV, you realise how much you've packed into a lifetime. So it's wonderful that it's recognised. But no, I've enjoyed the work that I've done, and it's still interesting.
So, Peter, how did you first learn about the OAM being awarded to you for service to medicine as a forensic pathologist?
Well, I was contacted actually a couple of years ago by a colleague whom I work with, who said that he had nominated me for this award. And I said, look, that's really very kind, and then completely forgot about it. And then about 3 months ago, I received notification through an email that my name had been put up, and various information was provided, and I had to indicate whether I accepted it or not, which I obviously did. Was greatly honoured. So, and it only got formally notified about 3 weeks ago that it had actually been approved. But so it's a great honour.
What did you do once you were infirmed? Did you tell your better half?
Well, I have no secrets from my wife, so we went straight to the bottle of French champagne in the fridge and the champagne. So, but we haven't. It's supposed to be kept confidential. As it happens, my daughter, or our daughter, and son-in-law were visiting from Sydney about 3 weeks ago, and we were actually at home having breakfast when I got the email, and it was very difficult to for me to keep a straight face.
Let's come back to your vocation. What is the most misunderstood concept of your field?
Well, firstly, as a medical practitioner, because forensic pathologists are doctors, clearly most people see forensic pathologists and understand what they do from their depiction on television and in the movies. And almost invariably, crime is involved and a lot of drama. And clearly the majority of the work that I've been involved in, and I and my colleagues have, doesn't involve crime. It is, I guess, the ultimate investigation. And it's the investigation usually of death, in particularly of how death has occurred. From my personal point of view, one of the biggest aspects, and that's often not realized, is actually identifying the dead body. It appears to be obvious to everyone if somebody dies and that person is known who that person is, but especially in situations of mass fatality and mass disasters, the identification of the body is not obvious, and in fact it can be very difficult to establish. So it's been, I guess, especially in the last sort of 15 to 20 years, the highest part of my role is to work in identification science, and is to work towards improving identification science. And I think a lot of people don't realize that's what a lot of forensic pathologists do, especially when they are involved in the investigation of mass fatality.
Peter, were you always interested in forensic science, or how did you start your career?
Well, as I said earlier, I'm qualified as a doctor, medical practitioner, and I qualified in the UK, but not long after qualification, I immigrated to Australia, to Queensland, and I went into pathology as a specialty. That was always my favourite specialty. It's the investigative side of medicine. Obviously, in the majority of cases, it's looking at what causes disease and identifying and diagnosing disease rather than treating it. As part of the training in pathology, especially in Queensland, forensic investigations became included in that training program. And indeed, the director of forensic medicine at the time, I was a junior trainee, was a gentleman known as John Tong, and some people will know the forensic facility in Brisbane as the John Tong Centre. And he was the director of forensic medicine at that time. And the reason why I mention his name is because he was instrumental in his recognition that pathologists should understand the forensic aspects of their work. He actually ensured that everybody spent some time in his institute as part of their training. So as part of my training as a pathologist, I spent several months in the Forensic Institute in Brisbane, and I guess the seed was planted at that stage, because when I then qualified as a specialist, while I initially didn't go into pure forensics, I actually worked here on the Sunshine Coast as the first pathologist up here. I clearly did all the forensic work there was up here, and I then took up a post in Sydney, which ultimately developed into the Director of Forensic Medicine at Westmead Hospital. So then I guess I'd had the seed of forensic investigations planted in my heart and brain from a fairly early stage in my career, and I never looked back from then. It was a fascinating time at Westmead. I spent about 20 years there before coming back to Queensland, and especially after the year 2000. I got heavily involved in forensic investigations of mass fatalities. It really started in 2000 when I spent some time over in Kosovo as part of the mass grave investigations after the Kosovo War.
What advice do you have for budding forensic science experts or all those kids who watch crime shows like you've just pointed out and would like to become a forensic expert in Australia?
I think it's a very good question. In fact, it's one I am asked quite frequently, especially by students who watch crime shows and watch television shows, and they are attracted by the drama, and they will ask about, well, what's involved. And so obviously I have to give advice as to the technical side of involvement, that in other words, getting a medical degree. And then going into pathology as a specialty, and then getting accepted into a forensic institute. But I'd also need to address I won't say the dangers, but the issues that one mustn't forget. The fact that the majority of forensic work involves dealing with the dead, and it can be very confronting. It involves dealing certainly with police, it involves maybe dealing with bereaved families, and one shouldn't assume that it's all going to be drama and excitement, where it can be a very, very confronting, especially some of the routine cases that you see. They can be quite unpleasant, and it's quite a difficult issue to address to ensure that people have the right approach and they understand what's involved. Another side of the process, of course, is that because there are many medico-legal aspects to forensic medicine, whether it's criminal or in on other aspects of legal in investigations, the involvement of the legal world, and particularly appearing in court and giving evidence, is something that we do routinely, but it can also be very confronting to stand up in a witness box and be questioned by somebody, and then have somebody else question you and almost try and make you not be a liar, but try and question what you've said. It can be a very confronting experience. It's not something that many doctors have to face, but forensic pathologists do that in their daily work.
Peter, you have been a part of Australian Federal Police's disaster victim identification team. What was your role?
Okay, well, DVI, as I indicated, involves the investigation of the deceased after a disaster, and it in some respects is a simple process. It involves examining bodies, getting certain information about them, and then finding out who those bodies may be, and getting names of missing persons, and trying to compare the information that you receive from the body with the information of the missing person. And so the forensic pathologist is responsible in particular for the examination of the body itself, so that we use fingerprint experts to take fingerprints, we use a forensic dentist to do the dental examination, but we're the ones that manage body holding and do autopsies. And we will collect that information, and we then hope that that will be compared with a list of who these people may be, in the hope that you will find one that matches, and then you can say you've identified that person. So DVI, disaster victim identification, is, as the name suggests, identification of the individual people and giving them a name. And the idea of giving them a name, of course, is that they can then be returned to their families and or to their countries or to their cultures.
Peter, let's turn to your work. Specifically, we're talking overseas. What do you remember of the 2002 Bali bombings, and what did you find upon your investigation?
Okay, in the Bali bombings, which occurred in sort of late 2002, there were some 200 victims, of course, and because it was, I guess, one of the first mass fatality incidents in which this country was involved in and heavily involved in, the teams that were sent over were fairly inexperienced at doing this disaster victim identification process. So when I went over, which was fairly late in the program, it was about I think a month or 6 weeks after the actual incident, quite a lot of the bodies had already been examined. When I got there, I obviously worked with the police team and the dentists who were there to examine bodies in conditions that were not ideal. The conditions in the Sanglah Hospital in Denpasar were not ideal, as they rarely are in such incidents. But we did the best we could to examine those bodies, collect information, and ultimately identify all the victims. Many of the incidents that occur overseas, even if they occur in countries that are sort of well advanced, are of a scale that the facilities available may need to be upgraded and updated. And so part of the process involves actually setting up the program to do that work. And it can be quite challenging. And it was in Bali, although, as I said, I was later in the program than at the very beginning. So most of it had already been set up. Things were different with other programs where I was either the first or among the first to attend.
What about flying to the Himalayas in Nepal and digging out the cause of the ill-fated 80 Airlines crash in Lukla Airport in 2008? How did you get involved into it?
Yes, when the aircraft crashed, information was received that the passenger manifest obviously had a number of people on board. I think the majority of them were German, but there were I think two Australian tourists on board. So the Australian Federal Police were informed and invited to send a team, and I was the pathologist on that team. It was a small team, just 4 people, sorry, 5 people. Essentially, the two police officers, myself, a mortuary attendant, and a forensic dentist, and we flew to Kathmandu. By the time we arrived in Kathmandu, the German team had been there for a little while, because I said most of the victims were in fact German, and so they had already commenced the process of identification. So we got involved fairly quickly because we wanted to ensure that the Australian victims were not only appropriately treated but also identified quickly. And with the cooperation of the German team, which is always very good, that was conducted very quickly. So we worked almost entirely in Kathmandu, as the body had been brought to Kathmandu. A couple of members of our team did fly up to Lukla to examine the crash site in case there was any personal property that was there, and that was very useful to have their involvement.
Peter, it must not have been easy for you to just fly over to Kathmandu and work on the crash. What were the challenges that you and your team faced?
As I indicated, the crash occurred in Lukla, which was fairly remote, and those bodies were all brought to Kathmandu. And this all happened before we arrived because the German team were the first there. And they managed to get the assistance of the local American authorities. They were very helpful and actually provided a large workshop area, which was then converted into a temporary mortuary. So that by the time we arrived, there was refrigeration created, and this temporary mortuary had been prepared. And it was very good. There were some limitations, and we made some improvements when we arrived. But they, given the fact that, as you say, the available resources are fairly limited in somewhere like Nepal, they're not used to something like that. But the Germans were very efficient, and they, as I said, developed quite a good mortuary, and we were able to then examine the bodies that were the two Australians and ensure that they were properly refrigerated, treated, and returned.
And was that your first trip to Nepal, or had it been there before, or?
That was my first, and at this stage, my only trip to Nepal, although, and we were there for about 5 or 6 days, I think. And of course, we tried to get a bit of downtime. There's a you, if you go somewhere like Kathmandu, you try and be as much of a tourist as possible, but there's a limit to what you can do and a limit to what you should do, of course. But yes, that was my only trip to Nepal, and I absolutely loved it. I still look at photos that I took. Remember them very fondly.
How do you remember that trip, apart from the investigations? Any fond memories we have?
We did take some photos. We went to, I remember we went to the sort of outer suburbs of Kathmandu, in particular, and I apologize for not remembering the name, but it was an observation site where you could obviously look out towards the Himalayas and towards Everest. I mean, I was told there's Mount Everest. In all honesty, it may have been Mount Everest, but one mountain will look the same to me as any other mountain, as it goes. But it was extraordinary to look around there. I have to say, one of our memorable visits was actually to the river there, where there was effectively a crematorium, and it was quite moving. It wasn't relating to our disaster. We were there effectively as tourists and looking around, and we're being shown, obviously, we had very gracious hosts who were showing us around, but it was marvelous, and the food was wonderful, of course.
So no Delhi belly for you in Kathmandu
No Delhi belly, no.
then. So do you plan to, obviously it's COVID and it's pandemic and everything is up in the air, but then do you plan to go back to Nepal and soak it all up once again once the pandemic is over?
I would love to. There's that as you get older, the bucket list probably gets bigger, but it gets more difficult to reach. So I would love to. My wife obviously wasn't with me because that was entirely a work visit, and I would love to take her back and show her Kathmandu in particular and have a look around. I did actually subsequently, because you will have seen from my CV, I was quite heavily involved with the Interpol pathology group. And in fact, I was the chair of that group for about 6 years. And as a result, I actually got contact with a lot of pathologists and investigators around the world, and have had contact with a number of people from the subcontinent, both India, Sri Lanka, and Nepal. So I do have a few contacts there. Not probably as good as I'd like to have, but we'll see.
Peter, you have just touched the human rights abuse investigations. How challenging are they for a medical professional like yourself?
Yes, a really good question, because they illustrated really significant issues for me, and that's largely related to the way in which I was activating both. With Kosovo, I was part of a team that was based in the United Kingdom that went over shortly after the Kosovo War, and their aim was to set up a forensic investigation system in Pristina, and also to start doing excavations and examinations to collect evidence for the War Crimes Tribunal. And that was fascinating. As I mentioned to you, my primary role was Director of Forensic Medicine at Westmead in Sydney. So I was, as well as being a forensic pathologist, an administrator. So being able to go and set up our program like that, which involved not only establishing the physical mortuary, but also the excavation and the collection of evidence, was very exciting and really interesting. challenging in the sense that you had to make do with facilities that had obviously been damaged through the war and were only beginning to be repaired. An interesting exercise. Also, of course, I'd never been involved in a, should we say, a conflict zone. And while there was no more fighting there when I was there, there was clearly military occupation, and we had to operate under the control of the military. So that was interesting in itself. With the Sri Lankan exercise, I was actually working for the International Committee of the Red Cross, and they had a different role, of course. Their role there, as part of their general philosophy of helping the what they call the missing people who are abducted and removed and killed as a result of war and conflict. There was also the war in Sri Lanka. The civil war had recently been terminated, so there was a peace treaty between the Tamils and the Sri Lankan government. And the International Committee of the Red Cross wanted someone to have a look at how easy was it going to be to do forensic investigations in Sri Lanka. In other words, to do excavations, to do examinations, but also to collect the evidence and to identify all the dead on both sides of the conflict. And so they asked me, they actually commissioned me, and I spent, I think, 3 weeks there in, based in Colombo, of course, working essentially as an ICRC worker, and therefore as a neutral person, but actually preparing a report in investigating the forensic facilities there, talking to Sri Lankan government, talking even to representatives of the Tamils up north, and ultimately preparing a report for them as to how easy it was. And to be faced with, I guess, real life exposure to governmental conflicts was something that, again, I had limited experience in. It was quite a challenge, an exciting challenge, and I think it was quite successful. But it, because I'm working for the ICRC, you're neutral, and so you're fairly well treated by everybody. And the time in Colombo was wonderful as well. Another place I'd love to go back to.
As a part of AFP and as a part of international delegate, what are the differences like? Do you find people treat you differently if you are part of something like International Red Cross as opposed to being part of an Australian government team, local public, and then the local authorities? Do they treat you differently?
That's a really good question. I think they do, but as I mentioned before, the whole approach is different anyway. So the purpose of my various tours with the Australian Federal Police, or effectively representing the Australian government, was purely as an investigator and to help identify and to not get involved in any kind of criminal or legalistic investigations. ICRC, we were there and are still there, of course, as an entirely impartial body who really just want to make sure that the right thing gets done. I've never been badly treated or mistreated or treated without respect by people that I've met in these operations, either people on my side or people that I've had to interact with in those various places. And I think they're grateful that the assistance is provided either by governments, as in the AFP, or by an organisation such as ICRC. I think they're very grateful that these assistances are offered and provided. And obviously, it's my role as the pathologist involved to make sure that the assistance is as effective as possible.
sbs.com.au